Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. It's time for another installment of Were They Great, where we explore the reigns of rulers who were given the title The Great in order to determine if they really deserved that honor. In this installment, we're looking at a king of the Anglo-Saxons who had much bigger plans for the island of Britain. In fact, we're looking at the only English-born king to ever be called the Great, and it is none other than the 9th century figure King Alfred of Wessex. Alfred is most well known for his attempts to unify the Anglo-Saxon people under one banner, the stepping stones to a united nation known as England, against the threat of the Viking raiders who were attempting to conquer the ununited kingdoms of Britain. Alfred's actions as King of Wessex helped to form an identity that was sorely lacking from the Anglo-Saxons under previous kings, especially considering the constant power dynamics that threatened the island. Under Alfred, many reforms were laid out to help the survival of his people. This included political structures being reworked as well as revamping the Saxon military to prevent domination from the Vikings. And above all else, Alfred wanted to instill his strong sense of morality that was carved out from his Christian upbringing. He was a king who faced many challenges to his rule, including his own possible constantly failing health. Heck, he wasn't even really supposed to be king at the time of his birth. In fact, he wasn't even supposed to be king up until all the rest of his brothers died out. If it wasn't for the fact that his brother's sons were children at the time of King Ethelred I's death, Alfred never would have ascended to the throne. And if Alfred's grandfather had not been as good a king as he was, at least in a military sense, Alfred might never have had a throne to ascend to. But we're not here to talk about Alfred's family. We're here to see if he's great. Are his reforms such as the Dane Law and the Doom Book worth remembering? I mean, that second one sure sounds interesting, right? So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the Kingdom of Wessex in the late 9th century in Alfred of Wessex. Was he great? In the background history lesson, we're going to talk about two different groups that attempted to conquer and colonize the island of Great Britain. One very successfully, and the other not as much, but still a group that left their mark. So first up, let's talk about the Anglo-Saxons, aka the ethnic group, technically groups, that Alfred called his people. Starting in the 5th century CE, Germanic groups from northern continental Europe started crossing over into England. However, we can find records of Germanic raiding dating back before then. During this time, the declining Roman Empire still held power on the island they called Britannia. Raiding parties, most likely from northwestern Germany and the modern-day Netherlands, sailed down the coast and would attack Roman forts along both sides of the English Channel. Because of this, the Romans ended up nicknaming the English Channel the Saxon Shore, even though we're not sure if the raiders were actually from the region of Saxony or not. Soon enough, the Romans started hiring Germanic mercenaries to protect Britannia from other Germanic raiders. Well, things continued to go belly up in Rome, and the island of Britain was soon left without the strength of the Roman army by about 410 CE. This lack of a central military structure made Britain much more susceptible to further Germanic invasions. As the raiders made headway on the island, they began setting up more permanent towns on the island. After a few decades, the raiding turned into waves of immigration. We mainly saw immigration from three main areas of North Central Europe. First was the Jutes. They came from Jutland, which is a peninsula in Northern Europe that constitutes the very northern part of modern-day Germany and the section of Denmark on mainland Europe. The Jutes mainly set up shop in Kent in southeastern Britain and the Isle of Wight off south-central England. Next were the Saxons. The Saxons came from Old Saxony, which corresponded to much of modern-day northern Germany. The Saxons mainly lived in southern Britain, creating the new petty kingdoms of Essex, Sussex, and Wessex, each respectively meaning East Saxony, South Saxony, and West Saxony. The Angles are the final group of the big three Germanic tribes. Historical records are slim about their homeland, but it's believed that the Angles came from the Angeln Peninsula, which straddles the eastern shore of the Jutland Peninsula, occupying space in both modern-day Germany and Denmark. The Angles were seemingly the most prolific in spreading out across Britain, as they would conquer everything north of the Saxon lands up into southern Scotland. This land would be divided into three different kingdoms: East Anglia, Mercia in central England, and Northumbria in northern England. Other Germanic tribes likely came from modern-day Belgium, such as the Franks, and the Netherlands, such as the Frisians. By the 7th century, the seven kingdoms of the Anglo-Saxons had more or less come together: Wessex, Sussex, Essex, Kent, Mercia, East Anglia, and Northumbria. Up until the early 9th century, Mercia would hold the most power. However, the Anglo-Saxons were no longer considered the invaders of Britain, unless you ask the native Britons, the southwestern Cornish, or the people of Scotland. New invaders were coming from further north. The first Viking raid in Britain, and in fact the first raid that some say kicked off the whole Viking era, was in June of 796 on the small island of Lindisfarne off of Northumbria. The monastery on Lindisfarne was sacked. As would become common practice over the next few centuries, the Vikings from Scandinavia continued raiding where they knew they could find more monasteries, which housed great amounts of gold and silver. Even though the Anglo-Saxons had originally been pagans worshipping Germanic gods, they had since converted to Christianity, meaning England was full of churches and monasteries. Like the Anglo-Saxons, the Vikings soon started settling in on the shores of Britain. Unlike centuries before, though, when Britain was unable to fight back against invaders, the Anglo-Saxons were armed and unwilling to let their kingdoms be taken. Well, things got a bit more dire when, in 865, the Great Heathen Army landed in East Anglia. The GHA was a coalition of Vikings under the leadership of several great warlords, a few claiming to be the sons of the semi-legendary Viking king Ragnar Lodbrok. Though southern Britain, here meaning Mercia and the Saxon kingdoms, was united against the Vikings, the northern kingdoms were much more open to their attacks. And it was within this time of the Norse settlers attempting to conquer the island of Britain that Alfred became king of the Saxons. So, Vikings. How did Alfred deal with them? Well, it's recorded by Alfred's contemporary biographer, a Welsh monk named Asser, that the future king of Wessex fought against a Viking raiding party in 868 CE, about 3 years before he would succeed his brother's reign. This raid was led by the Viking leader Ivar, also called Ivar the Boneless, who was sacking the kingdom of Mercia. King Ethelred, Alfred's older brother, was unable to beat back the great heathen army during his reign, meaning that the Scandinavians, usually referred to as the Danes by most sources, were able to set up shop in eastern Mercia. Ethelred's reign ended after several Saxon defeats, with several of those defeats happening within Wessex. Alfred's reign would begin following a fairly similar course. In fact, while he was overseeing Ethelred's burial, a Viking raid sacked the town of Wilton, once again located within the Kingdom of Wessex. To start off his relationship as king with the raiders, Alfred decided to broker peace instead of choosing to lead an army. This was mostly due to the fact that the Saxon army was fully unprepared to beat back the Danes after their previous defeat. However, this peace seemed to work for the time being. The Danes retreated from Wessex with a large amount of silver paid to convince them and set up for winter in the city of London, which back then was controlled by Mercia. For now though, Alfred had managed to keep his kingdom safe, and it would remain that way for the next 5 or so years as raiders attacked the other kingdoms of Britain. Wessex was once more put on the defensive in 876 when a new group of Viking raiders pushed their way into the kingdom. This time, they were led by a man named Guthrum. This group managed to capture the town of Wareham. When Alfred was once more able to lead a successful military operation to retake his land, he was forced to make a peace offering with Guthrum's army. However, after exchanging hostages and giving the Danes money, Wessex was taken by surprise when the Danes killed the Saxon hostages and retreated west towards Cornwall. This time, however, Alfred was able to rout the raiders, forcing them back into Mercia. This created a brief period of 2 years in which Wessex was safe from major incursions. Unfortunately, with the next major raid in 878, Alfred was taken by surprise as he had been celebrating Christmas outside of his capital of Winchester and was forced to take shelter further west. It wasn't until around Easter that Alfred was able to start rallying troops from the further west Saxon lands. Mounting a successful counterattack on the Vikings, Alfred once more took control of Wessex and forced Guthrum to surrender. Guthrum's defeat would create a massive change in the landscape of Anglo-Saxon Britain, which we'll get into later. But for now, Wessex, and most of Mercia for that matter, were safe and under Alfred's protection. Throughout the 880s, Alfred was able to keep Wessex safe while dealing with Viking raids and other Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. Most of this revolved around the Kingdom of Kent, the eastern neighbor of the Saxon kingdoms. Alfred also had to oversee a few naval battles off the southern shores of Wessex. Then, for some reason that isn't entirely clear, in 885, Alfred led an expedition into East Anglia, the lands controlled by his now semi-ally Guthrum. After an initial river battle, the Danes regrouped and pushed Alfred's army back into Saxon-controlled territories. Alfred's crowning achievement against the Vikings, though, was in 886 when he recaptured the city of London for the Anglo-Saxons. Once again, this was a landmark event that we'll talk about later. But Alfred's victory in London marked a turning point for both his power and the fate of the Anglo-Saxon people, at least for the next century or so. London was a major city and was a solid fortress, having been a key stronghold for the Romans. Having the city under his control, well, technically under the control of his son-in-law Ethelred of Mercia, would prove useful against further Viking attacks from East Anglia. In 888, Guthrum died, leaving a power vacuum in Dane-controlled lands. Nothing major would come of this until the 890s, when a large group of Scandinavians landed in Kent. This group, unlike most earlier raiding parties, consisted of warriors and their families, cluing in the Saxons that this was a full-blown conquer-and-colonize effort. While Alfred made efforts at peace with one of the Viking leaders, a man named Heston, the king's son, Edward, dealt with those that had split off and were raiding further north along the Mercian-Northumbrian border. After several years, in 896, the Vikings under Heston gave up their desires to conquer the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, at least in any meaningful way. Some returned to continental Europe while others retired to Northumbria. For the last few years of Alfred's reign, Wessex was free of major Viking raids. So let's now move on to that major peace treaty between Alfred and Guthrum. Let's take a quick break before getting to the treaty to do a little analysis. Alfred the Great is most well known for being the English king who repelled the Vikings. I'm gonna take umbrage with almost every other word in that sentence, even if it's a bit pedantic. Is it technically wrong to call someone who was Anglo-Saxon English? Some people would say no. I'm gonna be annoying about it because the country would not actually be England until Alfred's grandson. Also, as I hope I made clear, Alfred never actually fully repelled the Vikings. Not from Britain and technically not even from Wessex. The Danes very much still existed and somewhat thrived in Britain throughout all of Alfred's reign. And also, he never led a grand successful military campaign that pushed the Vikings out. He almost always had to resort to paying them to leave for a while. It wasn't until after he had both subdued Guthrum and retaken London that Alfred was able to actually start mounting successful campaigns against his foes. So let's talk about that first part. It's known by the simple name of the Treaty of Alfred and Guthrum. Technically, it was supposedly preceded by another treaty called the Treaty of Wedmore in 878, though only Asser ever made any contemporary notes of this one. In the Treaty of Wedmore, Guthrum was to be baptized and his army would retreat from Wessex. Surprisingly, Guthrum agreed to these terms. His new Christian name was Æthelstan, and Alfred hoped this would help him while ruling over the people of East Anglia. There's not much about Guthrum Æthelstan after he left besides that he ruled until his death in 888. I don't know how much of Christianity's laws he actually followed, and he's always called both a Christian and a pagan king after his baptism. We don't know when exactly the next treaty was formed, but it obviously had to be before Guthrum died, so most historians say around 880. The Treaty of Alfred and Guthrum was designed to help facilitate the existence of an Anglo-Saxon kingdom butting up against a Danish kingdom. So obviously the first part of the treaty is about the new legal border between East Anglia and Mercia. Yet we're not actually even touching Wessex's border with this. The official border was to start at the mouth of the Thames River, travel west, turn northwards at the Lee River, take that all the way to its end, make a straight line to the town of Bedford in centralish England, follow the River Ouse along its course until you reach Watling Street, which would form the northern border in north-central England. The second part of the treaty dealt with the Weregild, aka the amount of money you had to pay if you killed someone. The amount was set to be the same whether the person was Saxon or Dane, except that there was a different price depending on if you were a commoner or noble. The third article deals with clearing your name of accusations of homicide, in which you had to get the support of a number of thanes, a thane being a landholding noble. Again, this number was different depending on if you were a noble or commoner. The fourth article made it so you had to disclose who was assigning a warranty to an item being sold, which sounds simple enough and common sense. The fifth and final article had to deal with the legality of crossing the new border. Technically, it was illegal. However, you could do so if you wanted to trade. In the event that you were a Saxon wishing to trade with a Dane, or vice versa, you had to travel with a party and exchange hostages with each other for the period of trade in order to ensure proper behavior was kept. Kinda weird, but it was the medieval era and these people were bloodthirsty. The treaty between the Anglo-Saxons and Danes would prove to be relatively successful, at least as far as Wessex and East Anglia were concerned. Unfortunately, Mercia had more or less been divided in half vertically, with the Saxons maintaining the western half of the kingdom while the Danes received the eastern half. Overall, this new division resulted in the eastern and northern portions of what had once been Anglo-Saxon Britain being referred to as the Danelaw, the rightful land promised to the Danes and other Scandinavians by Alfred. Again, it is strange that one of the greatest peace agreements brokered by a man known as the Great resulted in his homeland, expanding that definition by quite a bit, being cut in half. But at the very least, the Danelaw functioned as a proper stopgap against major invasions for over a century, until a different king known by the epithet the Great decided to carve his name into history. But that's a story for another time. Let's now talk about Alfred's achievement with London, which would see him start to call himself not just King of Wessex, but King of the Anglo-Saxons. But first, let's talk about London itself, and by that I mean the history of the city. Fun fact, we don't really know what the name London means. The Romans called it Londinium, but that name no doubt came from a local Celtic word. There weren't any tribes bearing a similar name, so we're kinda out of luck to any further steps forward. There were signs of prehistoric developments in that area that is present-day London, dating to before 1200 BCE, but nothing of serious substance. That means that the first true settlement in the area of London was the Roman town of Londinium, built a few years after Rome first invaded the island in 43 BCE. This town held a strategic location on the River Thames and was also close enough to the coast where you could easily access mainland Europe. Unfortunately, around 60 CE, Londinium was attacked and destroyed by the Britannic Celtic Queen Boudica. By the year 70, the Romans had rebuilt Londinium and it was back to a functional place to live. In either the late 2nd or early 3rd century, the Romans built a massive wall around the city which further strengthened the location. As early as the 3rd century, London experienced attacks from Germanic pirates, but obviously nothing on the scale that would eventually become the Anglo-Saxon invasion a couple of centuries later. Also, despite some historical sources saying so, Londinium was never the capital of Roman Britain. That would be the city of Colchester. No doubt though, it was a major city for the Romans, the New York City to Colchester's Washington, D.C. When the Anglo-Saxons first took over, the remains of Londinium were mostly unused, though there's been discoveries in more recent years of Saxon structures built within the city that might date back to the 5th century. The Saxons themselves called the city Lundenwich and used it as a trade depot. The Germanic population inhabiting Lundenwich may have been the short-lived Middle Saxons, the people from which the modern English county of Middlesex gets its name. The Middle Saxons were eventually absorbed into the Kingdom of Essex, which itself eventually fell to the power of Wessex. However, when Mercia rose in power, it gained control over Londinwich from its southern neighbor. To catch up to our story, Londinwich was then captured by the Danes in the year 871 before Alfred recaptured it in 886. All of this was to more or less answer the question, how important was the recapture of London for the Anglo-Saxons as a whole? I'll admit that I was in a wrong opinion about the state of London in Anglo-Saxon England before I started researching this episode. I knew it wasn't the capital of England at this time, and it wouldn't become the capital until the Normans took over in 1066, but I didn't realize it might have still been an important city post-Roman occupation. As I'm American, I had to think of it in terms of, would recapturing London be akin to recapturing New York City, in this comparison a very important city, or something like, let's say, Peoria, Illinois, a much less important city and kinda just okay overall. I can say this because I went to college there. As I compared it earlier, London was obviously on the New York scale. But was recapturing London actually enough to let Alfred call himself King of the Anglo-Saxons rather than just King of Wessex? Now that I'll maybe fight against. I really want to say no because London was never the capital of an Anglo-Saxon kingdom. Middlesex's capital was most likely Colchester, and Mercia never had a single city be its capital for an extended period of time, and I don't believe it was ever London. However, as I've made very much apparent, London was kinda just this pan-Saxon important city. It was massively important for trade within Britain as well as with the continent. It's just that its supreme importance wasn't recognized until England received new ownership. So sure, Alfred could have the title King of the Anglo-Saxons. But what did he do with that power? Well, mostly rule over Mercia. East Anglia and Northumbria were now firmly Viking territory. Sussex, Essex, and Kent had fallen under Wessex's control within the past century, meaning Mercia was the only independent Saxon kingdom left when Alfred took London. The large kingdom also held supremacy over parts of northern Wales. And to top it off, Mercia was in a bit of a strange situation at this time. Before 879, Mercia was ruled by King Ceolwulf II. In 879, something happened to him and we're not entirely sure if he just died, was killed, or kinda just disappeared. Either way, instead of naming a new king, Mercy was put under the control of an elderman named Ethelred. After taking back London in order to cement his relationship with Mercia, Alfred had Ethelred marry his daughter Ethelflaed. Ethelred was never called King of Mercia, instead just being referred to as either Elderman or Lord of the Mercians. This heavily implies the lack of power he exerted compared to Alfred. So now that he's king of all the Anglo-Saxons, what did Alfred get up to in terms of creating a cohesive government? Let's talk about the Doom Book. Unfortunately, that name isn't as exciting as it seems because Doom, or Dome maybe, in this case is just the Old English word for law. This creates some fun sentences though, such as one written by Alfred that says, "Do not doom one doom to the rich, another to the poor, nor doom one doom to your friend, another to your foe." Anyways, the Doom Book was a compilation of laws and decrees Alfred created in the early 890s. It was a bringing together of his own personal thoughts as well as those of a couple previous Saxon kings Alfred admired. While the Code of Laws itself is already lengthy, a solid fifth of it is just Alfred's introduction. And it sure is quite the intro. In it, Alfred explains his thought process for making the Doom Book. He explains that, at the end of the day, the code is meant to exemplify good Christian values for the people of his hopes of a united England. Then the rest of the introduction is just Alfred translating massive swaths of the Bible into Old English. This includes the Ten Commandments, whole chapters from the Book of Exodus, and chunks from the Acts of the Apostles. The introduction was clearly showing Alfred's desire to connect the laws of the Christian God from the earliest days of Mosaic law under the Hebrews, through the early Christians, and up to his modern-day Britain. But as for the actual 120 chapters that made up the law book itself, well, it was messy. Modern historians have pointed out that the chapters are seemingly arranged at random, and many laws straight up contradict each other. It's completely unusable in an actual court of law, which again goes to show that this was less about Alfred creating a code of laws for day-to-day life in Britain, but more of a code of ethics he believed would preserve the Saxon people, especially in the eyes of God and Jesus. However, Alfred did make it so that basically any crime could be compensated with money. I already pointed out that the Wehrguild was very much a thing at this time, so even murder was able to be compensated. The only crime that could not be monetarily compensated was treason against the king, as the king was the most important figure, duh, this is Alfred's code, and held a sacred bond with God. But moving aside from the Doom Book, let's talk about another major part of life Alfred composed new legislation around. War. Obviously, the Vikings were a big deal, and the Saxons were not super skilled at keeping up against the raids. The major military reform Alfred enacted was the Burgle Hidage. Burgs were fortified settlements, and there were 33 in Alfred's system, most of them being in Wessex. Many of these settlements already existed, but Alfred really wanted to beef them up. Each burg was within 30 kilometers of another, making it much easier for the army to reach another within a day if a burg needed assistance. Meanwhile, a hide was a Saxon unit of land measurement that could then be used to decide things like taxes. Alfred's system would see the citizens of his lands become more involved with the upkeep of both the burgs and the army. One man from every hide was to help support the local garrison, and at least one man from a certain number of hides, at least five hides, was to serve in the Saxon army. The Burgle Hidage also helped Alfred update the tax system. Hides were expected to chip in a certain amount of money as a tax called the Danegeld, because it was created to originally help fortify the army against the Vikings, but would later just become a land tax. The entire system, though greatly expensive and caused an uproar among the nobles, proved to be highly effective. Vikings were much more used to smash-and-grab tactics for their raids. The fortified burgs were difficult to attack, and the raiders did not have the proper equipment to lay siege. So, overall, Alfred's reforms to Anglo-Saxon Britain, though not always the most sensical or popular among his people, helped the land thrive in a time of uncertainty. It created a sense of unity that would eventually coalesce a bunch of ragtag kingdoms into a unified nation, England. Just not under Alfred's rule. So, Alfred of Wessex. He was certainly a man who tried his best for the time he lived in, but was that good enough? And do his actions uphold to modern scrutiny? At the top of the episode, I said that he was famous for basically two things. One, he helped keep Wessex safe from the Vikings, and two, he led reforms to create a common Anglo-Saxon identity that could help create a singular nation of England. That's really why he's known as Alfred the Great. So, how did he actually do in terms of those? Well, he did protect Wessex from the Vikings, I can definitely say that. It's just that he didn't really do it with military might. He had two major victories, in 878 when he defeated Guthrum, and in 886 when he recaptured London. Wessex was constantly under threat both before, during, and for a bit after these victories as well. Though Alfred was able to restructure his army to make it capable of protecting Britain, he originally just had to pay off the Vikings. And the people under him had to cough up quite a bit in order to make sure the people terrorizing them were happy. But Alfred's main hopes were creating a united England. So how do you reconcile that with the fact that he gave up half of the English people to the Danelaw? Maybe he just cared more about Mercia and the lands controlled by Wessex. If so, then does he really deserve to be the only English-born king known as the Great? And he never even got those territories back. They wouldn't be regained until the rule of his grandson, King Æthelstan, a completely different figure from Guthrum Æthelstan, obviously. I feel like I'm being a bit harsh on Alfred, but that's mostly because all this time, in my head I've been comparing him to Brian Boru, the High King of Ireland in the early 11th century. Brian and Alfred were very similar figures, both being very Christian kings who fought back against the Vikings and sought to unite their heavily divided people under one banner. But here's the thing, Brian both united all of Ireland, even if it was briefly, and actually fought off the Vikings, at least those who hadn't permanently become part of the Irish population. If Alfred was the great prototype, then Brian was the sequel who did everything better. The Empire Strikes Back to Alfred's A New Hope, The Godfather Part 2 to Alfred's Part 1, The Shrek 2 of Kings of the British Isles. And Brian Boru isn't even called Brian the Great. That being said, Alfred was a man with a vision, and it was a massive one for sure. That vision may not have been fully realized, but my god did Alfred try his hardest. So with all that aside, King Alfred of Wessex gets a B- on the Were They Great grading scale. Better than some people I've covered, but not able to reach the heights of others. As I've mentioned a few times before, Alfred would not live to see the Kingdom of England take full shape. He passed away in the year 899 at the age of 50. Based on the symptoms of the extended illness he suffered from that Osser wrote about, it's been hypothesized that Alfred suffered from either hemorrhoids or Crohn's disease, a disease that can cause severe issues with your digestive tract. He was succeeded by his son Edward. Edward continued much on the same path as his father, managing to fight back the Danes in order to reclaim East Anglia for the Saxons. And as pointed out before, Edward was succeeded by his son Æthelstan, who claimed Northumbria and united all the Anglo-Saxon lands into the singular Kingdom of England. And you may be wondering why it's actually called England. After all, Alfred was from the land of the Saxons, and the Saxons actually outnumbered the Angles in terms of power on the island of Britain. Well, the simple answer lies in the name Anglo-Saxon. By the time Alfred was living, and even before then, Saxony back in mainland Europe was recognized as a nation, so everyone talking about the Saxons out in Britain had to make a firm distinction. So whenever the monks in England wrote about themselves and their homeland, they would call themselves Anglorum Saxonum, and that was eventually just shortened to Angli, in Old English, Angolchin. So, in order to not get a mouthful like Anglo-Saxon land for a nation, it was simply just called England. However, almost every Celtic language spoken on the British Isles, so Scottish Gaelic, Welsh, and Irish, refer to the English people using terms derived from the word Saxon. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. In a surprise twist, I will reveal that this episode was technically a part 1 of 2. So next time, we are sticking with the Were They Great series to talk about another king who ruled over England who was known as the Great. Alfred may have been the only native English king to win that moniker, but there was another man a couple centuries later who would go on to achieve high levels of fame. Next time, we'll be talking about Canute, the king of the Anglo-Scandinavian Empire. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.